Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and I'm joined by my comrade in arms and all things strategy, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Chair of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing very well. This may be the subject of a separate podcast, but I've decided I wanted to reread some old classics. And I just got this one, Solzhenitsyn's First Circle, which is probably his best novel, although some might dispute that. And what's interesting is this edition is the edition which includes about a fifth longer than the edition I remember reading originally, because he suppressed some parts of it in order to get it through the censorship. And what I've been told is that it's actually a much, much better book when you read the whole thing as he actually wrote it. And given everything that's happening in the world, it seems to me First Circle might not be a bad novel to read on a long plane trip, but we'll talk about that one later.
All right. Well, I'll be looking forward to that review. I mean, I will tease the fact to our audience that I had breakfast this morning with our mutual friend, Barry Strauss, friend of the Shield of the Republic show. And Barry told me that he is just finishing up a book on the Jewish wars in the ancient world. Very timely topic. It's going to be published this coming year. And so Barry will be back on Shield of the Republic to talk about that. But today we have a special guest, Jim Sciutto, who is the chief national security correspondent of CNN. He is a graduate of Yale, one of my alma maters. So I'm glad to have a fellow Eli on the show. He is also the author of Shadow War, The Madman Theory, and just out 2 weeks ago, The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. Jim is an extremely distinguished journalist, having won not only an Emmy, but the George Polk and Edward R. Murrow Awards. I guess, Jim, is that the equivalent of an EGOT in the news business?
I don't know if it's quite that level. I'm certainly honored. I'll await my EGOT someday.
Well, let's dive into the book, because it's you raise a lot of fascinating things in the book, which is extremely readable. You know, in Shadow War and Madman Theory, you were talking really about conflict in the gray zone, whether that was in cyberspace or in areas like the South China Sea, where the borders are somewhat fuzzy in terms of national sovereignty, and about former President Trump's very disruptive influence on international affairs. In this book, you're talking really about the prospect of really major war. And obviously some of that has been prompted by the war in Ukraine. I wonder if you could start by telling us how the war in Ukraine changed your perspective as a journalist looking at the international environment.
Actually, could you begin by describing what it is that you do as a journalist? That is to say, I mean, you know, you're at CNN, obviously one of the really major outlets, and you're a very senior journalist there. That's, I think, probably different from, you know, being a bureau chief here, bureau chief there, bureau chief somewhere else. So maybe if you could do that and then go to Eric's question as well. Because, I mean, one of the things that's striking about the book, it is a global perspective. You know, you're not just talking about Ukraine, you're talking about a whole bunch of places.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's great to be on with you, and I look forward to the conversation. So what does it mean to be a journalist? You cover the news, right? And that can mean the news that happens before our eyes, a container ship hits a bridge, right? Or a country invades another country, or a presidential election. I mean, the list goes on, a school shooting, right? I mean, there's the news that happens before our eyes. But then there's also, for someone like me, there's a beat, and I cover national security. So I am looking at topical issues under that umbrella every day, and that really spans from the Defense Department to the intelligence agencies to State Department and to officials and contacts and events abroad as well. So you have that beat aspect to it. And then what I try to do, and the reason I write books really, is that I find, and part of this is for my own intellectual process, but also a sense of mission, is to attempt to connect the dots for people, to explain which events and how these events are related to each other. And for me, for someone who has covered Russia and China, and the many ways and many places that our country and our allies interact with Russia and China for many years, what led me to write The Shadow War first 5 years ago was that I was noticing a pattern, right, of seemingly unrelated conflicts or interactions, or aggressive acts that actually were part of a matrix, really, a strategy that, interestingly enough, both Russia and China, two very different countries, were pursuing, which was to attempt to weaken the US and challenge the US and its allies, and to weaken and challenge the rules-based international order we talk about, the system that the US and its allies have helped construct over many decades, to generally keep the peace. Hasn't always worked, but to generally keep the peace. I consider part of my mission or my value add is to not just cover the news, but to explain how it fits into a broader picture. And that's what I attempted to do with the Shadow War 5 years ago, to say, listen, there's something going on here, right? These cyber attacks or these space weapons, these land grabs at that point, partial invasion of Ukraine or China's land grab in the South China Sea, are part of a broader challenge to the international system and to our interests. And we need to be aware of it. At that point, it was below, to your point, Eric, it was below the level of a shooting war, a kinetic conflict, and a shadow war. That's where I came up with that idea. It's just below the surface, gray zone activities. What struck me as I was sitting in Ukraine in February 2022, as the first Russian tanks were rolling across the border and the first cruise missiles were dropping on Ukrainian cities, was, well, the war's out of the shadows. This is the largest war in Europe in 80 years. You have a country attempting to change the borders of Europe by force of arms, and not just in a little way, not just slicing off a piece, say, in eastern Ukraine, or trying to turn Transnistria away from Moldova, but to absorb a country of 40, 50 million people, right? The largest country in Europe by land size, landmass too. That's a big deal, right? And that's a clean break. It didn't come out of nowhere, right? There were signs in advance, and there were smaller steps in advance, but that took the war out of the shadows and was a clean break, it struck me, with that period of relative peace and calm that we'd enjoyed post 1989, post 1991. History never ended. There was never the end of history, but we did have a respite, and it just struck me that that was the breaking point, and now it's out in the open. So, long answer to two short questions, but I hope I got there.
Let me ask you about how some of your sources saw this. So, one of the things that struck me pretty forcefully in reading the book is, at least in the European security side, when you're talking about that, two of your on the record sources were Mikko Hautala, who is the Finnish ambassador to the United States. He's a hugely experienced diplomat. He was the Finnish ambassador to Russia, served in Ukraine as well, and also was President Sauli Niinistö's national security advisor, but also the Prime Minister of Estonia, Kaja Kallas, who has been a persistent presence on international broadcasts about the war in Ukraine. And is now at least potentially a candidate for the NATO Secretary General job, although I suspect it'll go to someone more in the Western European mold. But what was it about this sort of frontline, Finnish Estonian experience, the Estonians already being in NATO, Finland transitioning into NATO, that you found particularly compelling? Because it did seem to me that there was a important message that they were transmitting.
Yes. Well, deliberately for this book, I wanted to talk to and meet and travel to the broadest variety of places possible in Europe, East and West. Here in the U.S., in Asia, spent time in Taiwan, and speak deliberately to people from different parties in each of those places to get the broadest view possible. I certainly wanted to listen very closely to what the Eastern-facing NATO allies, current and new, of course, Estonia has been in for a number of years, and Finland just joining, because they're closer to the Russia threat, and they're certainly more aware and more concerned about Russia's aggression. And by the way, they've got a lot of personal experience of it. They lived, speak to Kaja Kallas, they lived under Soviet rule just a generation ago. So they're not speaking out of, they're not guessing, right? They have real life experience of this. And it's interesting, Kaja Kallas said to me, and this is in the book, she said, listen, for a lot of our Western-facing NATO allies, this is an intellectual conversation, the discussion about the Russian threat. And she said, for us, it's existential that, he denies our existence. Putin does, much as he did for Ukraine, denies its the Baltics' right to independence. So for us, it's not just something that he might do someday. We feel it's a very clear and present danger. So they have a more pointed view, right, of that threat, and I think it's important to get that in. Now, I spoke to others that are further west, and it's not a clear-cut dividing line, right? Because when you spoke to a lot of UK officials, the UK has been very forward-leaning on this as well, and they're from the other side of the alliance. But and I spent time on a NATO task force in the Baltic Sea, which had half a dozen countries represented, a German flagship, the Portuguese, the Spanish, etc. So I spoke to a variety of folks, and I think that in general, the Finns and the Estonians, they have a lot of personal, very recent experience and proximity to the issue and face-to-face dealings with the Putins of the world. So you really do want to listen to them. They certainly have a more immediate fear, but I do sense that a lot of the rest of Europe is moving in that direction, right? That folks who used to dismiss the threat don't do so much anymore. But that's one reason why I spent a lot of time speaking to those folks in particular.
You describe in the book trying to make the case to your bosses at CNN that this threat is really very serious, and you talk about encountering a fair amount of skepticism. Now, to be fair, you also talk about encountering a lot of skepticism from people like Mark Milley, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Could you just talk a little bit about, how did those kinds of consensuses, that sort of consensus, form in the journalistic world, and how does it get broken? And is it any different from the way that consensus gets formed and gets broken, say, within government?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there are a lot of parallels, right? There are a lot of parallels to groupthink, right? That can take place in the news business as it does in the business world or in government. And I saw that during my time in the State Department as well. So they're not entirely dissimilar. And there was a commonality to that prior to the Russian invasion. You had a lot of folks, my colleagues in the news business, a lot of European leaders, right? Macron, among them. He was speaking to Putin days before the invasion, imagining that there was some deal that could be made. Zelensky, even, you'll remember, was downplaying the threat, worried that the US was exaggerating the threat of the invasion to the detriment of the Ukraine's economy. So there were a lot of folks who had that skepticism, which was built on a few things that struck me. One is, they had this impression. I think people invest Putin with far more wisdom than he actually has, right? You heard a lot of folks saying he's too smart to invade Ukraine. He's playing three-dimensional chess. This is all part of a plan to fool us, and we don't want to be fooled by it. Well, lo and behold, actually, he was planning, and there he rolled across the border. So I think some of it is just a misinterpretation of his intentions and his willingness to break through all the norms and so on, and that impression, despite a whole lot of evidence to the contrary, prior to February 2022, right? I mean, here's a guy who took a slice from Georgia in 2008, took two slices from Ukraine in 2014, carried out the largest nation-on-nation cyber attack on Estonia in 2007, a NATO member by then. This idea that, well, he would never touch NATO. In fact, he has. I mean, not like a full-scale invasion, but He has. And folks just weren't connecting the dots, as it were. And that extended from the news business to folks in government, a lot of folks in this country as well. And I think that's part of a larger phenomenon. I wrote about this in the Shadow War too, that and I spoke, for instance, in Shadow War to the late Ashton Carter, who copped to it, because he said, "I was part of, I was among the officials who," he used the term "mirrored," who looked at both Russia and China and imagined that, you know what, they want what we want in general. Even through years where there was a lot of evidence to the contrary, that mirroring phenomenon continued. And I think it continued right up to, for a lot of people, right up to February 2022. Now, there are still folks today, as you know, in this country who are like, "Oh, well, whose fault was the war?" And there's a candidate for president who says he could end the war in a day, and he knows what Putin's wants, and he could make a deal, et cetera, which again denies the facts before our eyes, right? So some of that mirroring or denial still exists today, but it was hard to break through. And the U.S. was trying to show the world by declassifying a lot of intelligence it would not have been done in the past. Satellite images of the forces on the border, intercepted communications of Russian commanders discussing invasion plans. So they were trying to push back against that, and for a lot of people, it wasn't convincing enough until the tanks started rolling in.
So one question, just following up on that, I was in Munich at the Munich Security Conference, like 2 days before the war broke out, and had been talking to a lot of European friends and acquaintances, and it was clear to me that one of the things that was introducing a lot of skepticism on their part was the memory of Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, and so on. So again, I know I'm going to be asking a lot of questions about the world of journalism. Was there a similar kind of filter on the journalistic side, do you think?
I had conversations. I remember I had a phone call with some of my colleagues who brought up that very point. They said, "Well, remember Iraq WMD?" And I said, "Okay, fair point, no question. But this is not, they can see these forces building up, right? They got pictures of them. It was, the when you looked at the balance of intelligence that went into this invasion plans assessment compared to the WMD assessment, what was the name? Curveball of that source. I mean, it was not as fulsome an assessment, one might say. And this one was more visible. It was tactile. Didn't mean that, Putin necessarily was going to make the call and order the troops in, but boy, he put the bulk of his conventional forces on, on the border of Ukraine, and his including building the field hospitals and all the stuff you would need for an invasion. And his generals were talking about the invasion. It was a pretty decently, sourced assessment. Again, you know better than me, having had security clearances as well, that assessments are assessments, and they're incomplete information, and the best judgment of that information, the best analysis of it. But this information was certainly more complete than the Iraq WMD one. And by the way, it turned out to be true. Now, what didn't turn out to be accurate, right, was how that war would progress. Because as you remember, the assessment was that the Ukrainians were going to get routed in a few days, but that didn't happen. They surprised on the upside. So it's not perfect, but they were at least right about the invasion.
Yeah, a couple of points I would make on that. One is, I actually wrote something around December of 21, in which I described what the administration was doing as an attempt at deterrence by disclosure, that they were doing something we did occasionally in the war on terror, which is publicize the information we had about a potential impending terrorist attack in the hope that you would take your adversary kind of out of their, planning cycle and force them to go back and start over again. This was done in a much more systematic way, and obviously not against a non-state actor, but a state actor. And I mean, to the point, your point, Jim, about Curveball. I mean, so Curveball, of course, was a German source that we, the RIC, used on the mobile biolabs. That was the idea that Saddam Hussein had mobile biolabs. One of the things that struck me about what the Biden administration was doing, it was much less collateral from other intelligence services involved here. This was much more U.S. intelligence being disclosed.
Yeah.
So they didn't have to go through the process of getting allies to agree, you know, to disclose. They failed in the end, you know, to actually deter Putin, but they did, I think it's fair to say they did set themselves up for success in the sense that they created a predisposition to disbelieve what Putin and the Russians were saying about various false flag kinds of operations. And they, I think, laid the groundwork for the very, something you describe, which is a very close allied cooperation in supplying Ukraine once the war, you know, actually started. So, I mean, I give them, you know, a high points for that. You broke some news just as the book was coming out, because you have a discussion of events that took place in the fall of 22. You were just talking about the Russian failure to seize Kyiv and decapitate the Ukrainian government and wrap this all up in 72 hours. By the fall, it was actually the Ukrainians who were taking territory back. And you describe in some detail something that David Sanger of the New York Times also wrote about the same time that your material appeared on the CNN website just prior to the publication of the book, which was the fear that American officials had that in the fall of 22, in the face of these battlefield setbacks, that the Russians were potentially preparing to use theater nuclear weapons. And I'd like to dig into that a little bit. I mean, it's interesting that right around the time, I think just after, certainly before your book was published, but after you had written it, there also was a leak of some Russian nuclear planning documents to the Financial Times that purported to show that the threshold for nuclear weapons use by Russia was lower somehow than it had been in the past. Although when you look at the documents, I mean, you look at the accounts of the documents in the Financial Times, and I think it was the Times of London as well may have gotten them, it's hard to see how it actually differs from Russian doctrine as we know it, which has always suggested that if the nature of the regime was in threat as a result of either conventional or nuclear attacks, Russia reserved the right to use nuclear weapons. But in the episode you describe, and it's you have great detail in the book on this, U.S. officials not only started to hear chatter about this among Russian officials, they also got very alarmed about the Russians talking about a potential Ukrainian dirty bomb, which would then be the cover, the false flag cover for a Russian use of theater nuclear weapons. And I want to just ask you about that. I mean, you acknowledge that the sources you used, and presumably there some overlap between the sources you had and David Sanger did, because they tell roughly the same story, that although there was no movement visible of nuclear weapons, normally those of us who watch this stuff when we were in government would be looking for the 12th GUMO, the 12th general office of the Ministry of Defense, which is responsible for nuclear weapons, to actually be moving them around on trains or trucks or whatever. There was no movement, but there was talk. Now, of course, because of the previous episode we were just discussing, the U.S. making public a lot of Russian planning, Russians knew we were monitoring what they were saying. So, what, you know, there's a judgment being made here. Your sources were telling you that the judgment inside the administration was, this is very serious, they might be considering it. And you detail all the steps they took, getting China, India, others to weigh in, with the Russians weighing in through various channels directly, sending Bill Burns, our former colleague, to speak with Sergei Naryshkin, the head of the SVR, the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service. But there's another potential story here, which is that President Biden had said very clearly at the outset of this that he wanted to support Ukraine, but not at the point of having World War III, There had been a lot of discussion at the outset of the war of the potential for nuclear escalation. This is something that the Russians knew was a neuralgic point for the administration. So how do we know that this was genuine, not conversations held for the benefit of the listening big ear of, of the intelligence community, and that it wasn't what the Russians call reflexive control, which is the, really an idea as old as Shunza, trying to get your adversary to do what you want by making them think that you're going to do something that they, you know, therefore must take some action to preclude. How do we know this wasn't really an information op?
So it's an assessment, right? And assessments are built on a number of pieces, and rarely are assessments 100% right. Some are more correct than others. Like what I reported before the New York Times, I will note, although, and David gave me credit for that, is that they had a number of pieces that led them to this assessment. And I'll walk through those pieces again. I mean, you touched on them. One, at the time, Ukraine was losing ground in the south. They had just lost Kherson, which was its biggest prize, the biggest city it had captured during the invasion. And they were losing further. The Russians did, yes. And the Russian forces, thousands of Russian forces were in danger of being surrounded and cut off by Ukrainian forces. So there was concerned that that would have been such a catastrophic loss that it was pushing Russia to consider the use of a tactical nuclear weapon. In addition to that, you had this public campaign, if you want to call it that, by senior Russian officials, Sergei Shoigu and others, to claim that, well, actually, Ukraine is planning some sort of radiological attack. Perhaps a dirty bomb, perhaps an attack on Zaporizhia, etc., and the world has to be prepared for it. And Shoigu was calling up all of his colleagues around the world. That was another piece. The U.S. read of Russian military doctrine, which is, you know, as you know, not an exact science. I mean, there are some foggy pieces in there, but their read was that Russia might view the loss of ground in the south and the potential loss of many thousands of forces as a potential threat to the entire operation, to territory which they claimed as Russian, even though it was Ukrainian territory, and therefore a threat to the state, and Putin is the state. So it might qualify for their, you know, for a tactical nuclear attack under their military doctrine. Again, it's not an exact science, but that was their read of it. And then thrown into the mix, intelligence intercepts of Russian commanders speaking about it, much as they had intercepts of Russian commanders speaking about the invasion several months before. So they took all those pieces together and said, this is serious. Now, the other piece in terms of not having seen the movement of the weapons, these officials acknowledged to me they did not see that, but they said, we aren't sure that we would see it in this case, because you would know if they were moving warheads onto an ICBM, but if it was a tactical nuke, which could be fired with conventional systems already in place in Ukraine, you might not see it. So that element of uncertainty led them to say, okay, we have to take this so seriously that we have to communicate this directly, for instance, Bill Burns to Naryshkin, Milley to Gerasimov, you know, all along those lines, our allies to Russia, and then enlist unconventional allies in this case, which was China and India, to get on board and say, you got to warn Russia away from this. And sources in the book give credit to Chinese and Indian efforts, some of which were public comments, statements that Xi Jinping made when I believe it was the German chancellor was visiting him, statements before the UN by the Indian Minister of Foreign Affairs. They consider that helpful. So anyway, that big picture, including the seriousness with which Russia, China, and India were taking the threat, led them to, if they didn't know 100%, they were certainly concerned about it. And that's where it came about. Could Russia have been playing games with us? I mean, we know that Putin rattles the nuclear saber frequently in his public comments, often to needle. That happens, there's no question. And by the way, for this book, I spoke to officials in Europe who do believe, and Kai Kalas being one of them, that we allow ourselves to be snowed by the Russians on the nuclear threat because Russia knows, as you say, that we get really scared about that. So anytime they want to, you know, kind of scare us away, they'll say, oh, by the way, we have nuclear weapons and we might use them, you know. So there is some of that. But and that's happened multiple times from Putin and Medvedev and others, but not with these other ingredients, you know, the potential loss of Russian forces, forces on their back foot, the intercepted communications, etc. So that, in their view, it was different and more real.
So as you probably can tell, Eric and I have dark, suspicious minds. And I mean, like Eric, I frankly, I share the suspicion that the Russians were deliberately playing this up. And because at the end of the day, from their point of view, even if there is, you know, the administration runs around and rallies people, to, you know, tell them not to do it, that's not a bad situation for them to be in, that, you know, people feel like we're just barely holding these people back from using nuclear weapons. I have to say, I also, obviously, I haven't seen any of the classified intelligence in a very long time. The idea that people would move tactical nuclear weapons around with no special security measures, no special communications links, I find that very hard to believe. I don't think that you move those around the way you move 152 millimeter artillery shells around. But I, the even nastier and darker suspicions that I have to do with what is, you know, intercepted communications among Russian generals. That's pretty sensitive stuff. Signals intelligence, which at one point you couldn't even talk about, is still one of our most highly classified and one of our most valuable sources of intelligence. And sometimes governments very deliberately tell journalists about these things, as they did at the outset, and for very good purpose in that case, you know, to try to see if they could deter Putin from invading by saying, we know what you're doing. So help me understand why all of a sudden U.S. government officials a few months ago, or however long ago it was, decide that it's okay to share with two of the country's most prominent national security journalists the fact that we're listening in on Russian general officer telephone conversations. And this is really about the craft of journalism. How much do you have to worry about that when you're reporting the story?
Okay, well, let's see, a few questions. Listen, is there an information warfare aspect to this? Absolutely. And you know, U.S. officials have spoken quite openly about revealing and declassifying intelligence that they would not have done in the past, in part to achieve ends. I mean, one way they did that was to, early stages of the war, they exposed Russia's planned false flag operations in Eastern Europe. They all had a whole host of plans in the works to, for instance, carry out quote-unquote terror attacks in Eastern Ukraine, blame Ukrainian terrorists, Nazis, etc., requiring a, you know, Russian military action in the country. But the, you know, the U.S. got wind of them and said, hey, this is what the Russians are going to do, and you defuse those false flag operations. So there's some clever information warfare, you know, as when intelligence gets either, you know, shared with reporters or publicized in other ways. That there's no question. There's no question that that happens. And listen, as a journalist, you have to be aware. You know, with any source, under any circumstances, whether it's an intelligence story or a political story, you got to know your source, right? And you got to know whether your source has an axe to grind. Then you have to plug that into the broader picture, you know, so that you could just run it through your own credibility filters. For me, for instance, with the intelligence that was shared and declassified prior to the Russian invasion, I'd been covering this for some time, right? I'd been in Ukraine going back to 2014, and I'd been writing about and reporting on and doing interviews about Russia's other aggressive acts around Europe and around the world. So it fit into that broader picture. It didn't come out of nowhere, right? So I found it personally credible based on the trend lines I've been covering, you know, for some time. And that's part of the process as well. And again, not dissimilar from the way an intelligence analyst might look at it, right? They're going to look at the individual pieces and say, well, this fits in with the broader picture. And I certainly don't have access, you know, I did have a top secret security clearance when I was in government, but I don't have it anymore. So I have to, I have to, use less of that information to try to build a story that I find credible. I will say, listen, that a lot of the questions you're asking about this nuclear scare and the doubts you're expressing aren't entirely dissimilar than the doubts many expressed prior to Russia's invasion, right? They're like, well, and that was exactly the read that many people had. They're like, well, Putin is doing this just to scare Europe, right? He's playing three-dimensional chess. He's not really going to invade. Trump said that many times, but of course he did. And I'm not saying they're equivalent. I'm just saying that, sometimes, listen to what they say, right? They end up following through on it. And it's not the first time that intelligence agencies have done this. I look back to the 2016 election and Russian interference in the 2016 election. When you look at that intel report in January 2017 that described Russian interference and what its intent was, it was based in part on not just intel intercepts, but intelligence, it seems, gleaned from the highest source the U.S. has ever had, the Kremlin, right? And it may have been part of the reason that, and by the way, that was a story I reported first, the extraction of that Russian spy. It may have been part of the reason that Russian spy was taken out of the country, right? So there had been other times when they were like, listen, and you do that with some awareness of the costs, right? That you might very well lose such a source like that, or expose a source, and so on. That's all part of the judgment they have to make. And listen, all of us have to be aware of how this kind of stuff is weaponized, even by our side. So we have to go into, we have to enter this with some skepticism and not believe everything you say or hear, and try to run it through whatever credibility filter you have. And it's tough. It's not easy, right? You don't always get it right. You just try to do it as best you can.
Yeah, if I could follow up on that, because no, I agree with you. And I think, I think sometimes people think that top-notch journalists are easily spun. And I don't think that's really true. Mm-hmm. The follow-on I wanted to ask you, though, is, as you just mentioned, you did have a couple of years in government serving in the embassy in Beijing. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of journalists don't have that experience. Did it affect how you do your job as a journalist? Does it affect how you report stories and how you understand, simply how you understand what's going on in the world?
Yeah, it absolutely, I learned so much, I got to say. And it's, I feel lucky for it, right? I got to serve, and it's the reason I took the job, to be in the middle of this relationship between the US and China at a consequential time, and to not just have a security clearance where you can read the reports and the analysis, but also be in the room for meetings with senior Chinese officials. And things happened while I was there. If you remember, while I was there, the blind dissident, as he was known, Chen Guangchen, took refuge in the U.S. embassy. That was a major international issue between the U.S. and China. So I got to witness those things, provide the best advice I could in those circumstances, and be involved. So that was just, I learned a lot, right? Just straight up. But I also learned, something I knew to some degree, but there's no substitute for being in the middle of it, that, listen, I think from the outside, we can have this impression that the government knows everything, right? I mean, you have the largest intelligence apparatus in the world. They have all these sources. They know they can take a picture of anybody from space a million miles, all that kind of stuff. We kind of like, they know everything and intercept. The truth is, they know a lot, right? But again, they're imperfect people working with imperfect information, often making the best judgments they can. They have enormous tools that I don't have, but they get stuff wrong and they get stuff right. And some are high confidence assessments, some are low confidence assessments. There are people with axes to grind inside and outside of the government. So you learn that as well. And that's, that's important to know, because and to see play out, because it just helps you, I think, it helps you, for instance, when you're presented with a story like intelligence on the Russian invasion. It helps you run it through your kind of credibility filter. And the final thing I'll say is that it also gives you, listen, government is flawed. We've all worked in government. But by and large, they're generally good people trying to do their best, with the country's best interests at heart. There are exceptions to that, but in general, these aren't bad people, right? And particularly today, when everybody's lost confidence in every institution, I think that that's an important message to get out. We've got a lot of good people doing their best, making enormous sacrifices, working in difficult countries under threat, away from their families, and trying to do their best. I think that's important for us to know too, because the nature of my job is adversarial, right? With the people, and that's the way it should be, right? Because you don't want to be their best friend, right? You want to have some distance, but doesn't mean you have to distrust them or think that they're horrible people, right? Or think they're out to get you, because that could also be insidious in its own way, right?
Yeah, that's a really important point, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and I think both Elliot and I agree with that. We try to, I mean, we've got plenty of criticisms of the current administration, but we try to remember our own times in government and what it felt like when you're in there, sort of beleaguered. And I have discovered though that once you leave government, you immediately add 25 IQ points, and you're so much smarter than the people who are still behind in government. And I've also noticed that when you testify before the Congress, when you're an outside expert witness, you get treated with so much more deference and kindness than you do when you're an administration witness of whatever administration. I try to keep all that in mind. You talked about your time in China with Ambassador Locke, Jim, and you talk in the book about your discussions in Taiwan about the, Cross Straits flashpoint that we all know is out there. And a lot of your discussion focuses on Taiwan's lessons from Ukraine and what they're learning and how they've concluded that they are going to have to fight, if they have to fight, an asymmetric conflict, and that they have to, as you describe in the book, make themselves into a very undigestible meal for the PRC, a porcupine, as it were. But my sense of this, because people have been talking about this now for kind of almost a decade, about trying to create dilemmas and problems for a Chinese amphibious invasion, which would be a very difficult military undertaking across 90 miles of open ocean. It'd be a very hard thing to accomplish. Certainly the Chinese military has never done anything on that scale or like that. But my sense is that Taiwan is not very far along, and nor are we in helping them become a porcupine. I mean, it's been a lot of discussion, but we haven't really quite gotten there. Is that your sense as well, or do you think more progress has been made than I'm allowing?
I think they're definitely making progress. I spoke to Admiral Lee Shimin, you may have met, who was their, I suppose, sort of their equivalent of chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and he comes from the Navy side. And he's one of the folks who's been pushing for this transition for some time, pushing Taiwan to adjust its way away from sort of, legacy weapon systems or, big ships, power projection, and more on asymmetric defensive weapons, and training their units to be more mobile and that kind of thing. And he speaks quite openly in the book that that took, he had to fight, right, to get that view across, and there certainly are still skeptics, but it does seem like it is changing, and some of that pressure is coming from the States and the kinds of weapons that we sell them, right? Different than you did in the past. And I went and I spent time with both the Navy, the Air Force, and the Army units who were training for to defend the island, and they, they take this very seriously. They watch for lessons from Ukraine. They certainly speak the language of asymmetric warfare, and if they don't quite say porcupine, but they, in that kind of in that kind of general view. So, the challenges are still enormous, right? Even if you snapped your fingers and they had that kind of force tomorrow, this is still China, right? We're talking about, which is ginormous, and Taiwan is small, and though it's surrounded by water, China has weapons systems that could really devastate that place in a short period of time, right? Now, at tremendous cost to China's own forces, because Taiwan also has tremendous capabilities, and this president at least has committed the US to some sort of military intervention to defend Taiwan, and that, when you look at the war games, are just devastating for everybody. So doesn't make the picture any easier. But I like the way Milley described it is you know, the U.S. strategy is effectively not today. That, you know, they hope to inject enough doubt into Xi Jinping's calculation that he wakes up in the morning and looks at the picture and says, not today. And then the next day, you hope he does the same thing.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's an interesting thing. This is a larger issue in a way that's how we think about it. I mean, we used to think if we could end up in a war, and if it's a war, you want to make sure that you can win. And I think even within government, to a remarkable degree, that's not how we frame things. It's even, you know, it's interesting that Milley, a general, would frame it that way, that we just want to, you know, we're designing forces to inject doubt, which is quite different from saying we're developing forces that can really prevail. You know, one thing that strikes me about the book is it doesn't really talk about the Israel-Gaza war. Of course, it was already in production. Do you view that war as just kind of orthogonal to the central issues that you're talking about with Russia and China? Or if you had more time and you'd written the book, you know, maybe a year from now, do you think you would you have tried to weave that in some way as well? How does that fit into your conceptual framework?
Sure. Well, fair question. I'll be honest with you. I was in Israel late October, early November, following the October 7th attacks. I'd already just about handed the manuscript in, and I called my editor and I was like, "We got to talk about this." And I added, listen, I was not going to be able to add another, you know, 100 pages to the book on it, just based on time. And of course, the events were still happening, so it wasn't quite clear how things were going to play out. But it was clear, and I spoke to senior Israeli officials and U.S. officials as well, that Russia was doing what it often does, which is part of the broader picture, which was just stoking the flames where it could, right? It liked to see the U.S. mired in something in the Middle East and America's ally, although, of course, Russia has a deep relationship with Israel as well, but America's ally in trouble, that just occupies us in a way that they see as advantageous to them. And I thought it was notable, and I note this in the book, that Russia sent an S-300 system to Hezbollah in the midst of this via the Wagner Group, but certainly with the Kremlin's okay, which is would be a nice way to make it more difficult for Israel if it were to have a northern front, maybe protract that end of the war, which is kind of a classic Russian thing to do, which is just disrupt. And, you know, as Bill Burns tells me in the book, he's like, you know, Russia's view of the international order that, you know, Putin's the kind of guy, in his words, who will bring the temple down. You know, they like to disrupt, and you saw some of that. Now, yes, to your point, had I written the book later, there would be a longer section on that. But I do think you at least get that sense of how they operate. Now, it is interesting. I have spoken to sources and officials in the region who have made the point that, to some degree, Russia is sort of odd man out in this conflict, right? That it has less influence than it imagines on this one. But it doesn't take a lot to disrupt, and Russia's pretty good at disrupting because they don't mind the chaos, you know.
And that's been their traditional policy in the region for a long time, which is to just, you know, keep the pot boiling and keep the United States, you know, preoccupied. And its attention focused on that. You mentioned when we were talking about Taiwan, you know, President Biden's statements that he would, you know, unequivocally defend Taiwan, mm-hmm. including at least on a couple of occasions to your CNN colleague, Anderson Cooper. It was quite striking to me that recently presidential candidate Donald Trump said, absolutely, I wouldn't defend Taiwan. And, you know, China's big, Taiwan is small, you know, what, you know, they compete with us, you know, why would we defend them? Which may have come as a shock to some people who think that the Trump presidency was a big, you know, a big effort to reorient us towards the pacing challenge of China, as his national security strategy and national defense strategy suggested, at least in formal documents. You have a whole chapter in the book about Trump. That is, I think, perhaps in a book that has a lot of things in it that are sort of scary and terrifying, is perhaps the most terrifying thing of all. Because you rely very heavily on the record comments from people who worked very closely with Donald Trump, you know, on national security matters day to day for extended periods of time. I mean, have in mind John Kelly, former chief of staff, former secretary of Homeland Security, and John Bolton, former national security advisor. I've had similar conversations, by the way, with both of them. And both of them, you know, as you recount in the book, basically say he is not fit to serve as president of the United States, and that a second term would bring almost incalculable risks to the nation's security and to the rules-based global order that you've talked about earlier. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, you've already written a book about the madman theory about, you know, Trump's, you know, disruptive effects. Mm-hmm. And you talked to other people who were less anti-Trump, but also had reservations. I'm thinking my friend Matt Pottinger, for instance, former deputy national security advisor. But how did you think about that chapter? I mean, typically that's not the kind of chapter you see in a book like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing. It just struck me that you couldn't write a book about the return of great power competition without describing the two, frankly, diametrically opposed approaches that you have, that this country is going to make a decision about, you know, in the November election. Whatever your politics, the Trump versus Biden view of the world is vastly, vastly different. And the U.S. place in the world and how to adjust to this new era of gray power competition. And it's not like a incremental difference, you know, 10 degrees this way, 10 degrees that way. It's really 180. And as you say, John Kelly and Bolton and others say, you know, if Trump will be reelected, Ukraine aid ends. And that, you know, Trump has said that himself, so you don't have to guess about it. The U.S. will not defend Taiwan. I mean, there's a story I tell in the book. Bolton said Trump used to sit in the Oval Office, point at his Sharpie and say, see the tip of that pen? That's Taiwan. See this desk? That's China. To make the point that Taiwan has no chance against China, and therefore we have no business defending it. So they say in quite explicit terms, if I'm Ukraine, I'd be worried. If I'm Taiwan, I'd be worried. They make the point that just as he has no real interest in NATO and doesn't see it in America's interest, and they say that he very likely will attempt to get the U.S. out of NATO. And if not, due to legislation and Congress won't ratify, he'll effectively neuter it by, as commander-in-chief, rendering Article 5 meaningless because, and again, this is something he said out loud, I'm not, Russia, do whatever the hell you want, right? And they tell the story in there about how he very nearly pulled the U.S. out of NATO in 2018. But they say he has a similar view of U.S. defense alliances with South Korea and with Japan. So that's a retreating America, huge consequences for our allies and for parts of the world that we as Americans are used to going to safely, et cetera, and doing business in. That's a big choice. And he also imagines that out of pure force of will and personality, he can make deals with Xi and Putin to sort of, you know, he's willing to accommodate and find peace, which to me strikes me as not fact-based, because these are strategic decisions by Russia and China to undermine the U.S., weaken the U.S., and break down the system. You know, the best negotiator in the world cannot change those countries' strategic interests. So that's a big choice. And again, you know, like you say, don't believe me. Believe the guys who worked with him very closely in the last administration, because they say this very much on the record. As I was writing the book, it's not a political book. It's about the world. But America's place in the world is consequential. And we have an election coming that will decide, you know, a quite dramatic difference in approaches to that.
You know, in a book that has a lot of powerful parts, I have to say I thought that was the most powerful, and it's disturbing. We're running to the end of our time here. I had one last question I wanted to ask you. You've got this vast beat, national security. I mean, it literally global. You must have some stories that you think, gosh, I really wish I could devote more time to this. I think it's really important, but I'm just spread too thin. Could you just tell us what one or two of those stories might be?
If you're saying if I were to go to the place and tell them or squeeze it into the book,
Well, either one. So stories that you think you would really like to see being told to the American people or to a global audience, and CNN is global, that, you know, just don't get told enough.
I think this is one of them. I think that when we talk about the election, we talk about it in a lot of ways, we don't talk enough about what a consequential decision this will be for America's place in the world. I think that's quite important. But I also think we don't do nearly enough coverage of how the great powers interact in the global South, because there is a great game underway on the continents of Africa and Latin America today. China with the Belt and Road, Russia with various coups, and you name it, to establish influence in there and often successfully. It's not perfect. And I also think that, you know, this is just from perspective, we don't want to approach either Russia or China as 10 feet tall, because they have their own weaknesses. Russia's economy is decrepit. They just lost their entire European market for energy. They've got an aging population. China's economic growth is flattening, and it's hitting this demographic wall, etc. So we don't ever want to give the impression that they're perfect. And when I look at Belt and Road, that's one example. I mean, Belt and Road kind of ticks a lot of people off, right? Because China comes in. I mean, think of Sri Lanka, and they build this port, and they're like, "Oh, you're in debt. Actually, I want that port for 99 years." Sounds a lot like Hong Kong, by the way, which China is still burning about. You know the treaty there. So, I think Global South, we have to spend a lot more time looking at how this is happening there, where the U.S. is behind and where it needs to interact more similarly in Latin America. And then I think the Arctic, too. And I talk about the Arctic a little bit in this book, and I've done some stories up there, but that is another great game where you have certainly the U.S. and Russia head-to-head there, but also China as a player in that space. As the ice melts, it's both a business story, but it's also a national security story. And one of my favorite trips ever was to go on a U.S. sub during the ICEX exercises up there and bust through the ice and walk out and kind of, you know, see the forever sunlight, but also be part of those exercises, which are, you know, part of this cat and mouse game, keeping your eyes on Russian subs as we're testing each other out. I think those fields of play, they may seem far away, but they're really active right now.
Yeah, you touch on the space issues in the book, and you know, one thing I know I'm concerned about, and there's been a lot of attention, obviously, thanks to Chairman Turner of the House Senate or House Intelligence Committee, about whether the Russians are or aren't going to put a nuclear weapon in space. But you know, China has become, you know, the major spacefaring country over the last couple of years, which is a story we haven't paid much attention to, and building a lot of ground stations in Latin America.
Yes.
And very, very worrisome, because I can't recall now whether you talk about it or not, but the launch several years ago by China of a fractional orbital bombardment system, which approached the United States from the south rather than the north, which we lack, or we're changing it, but we at the time lacked the ability to track. It was very, very worrisome for what it says about potential Chinese intentions as they become a nuclear peer, which is something you do talk about in the book.
Yeah, definitely talk about space. I talked about this in The Shadow War, and I talk about it in this book too. That's another example. When I try to explain this to audiences, that we may like to think that this is a distant problem, and you know, the Ukraine war, Taiwan's far away, it's not really our fight. But you know, first of all, I believe from a values perspective, it is our fight, and also that as these systems break down, that does not serve our selfish interests too. It's not just for the sake of the sovereignty of the Ukrainian people or the Taiwanese people. It's also because we benefit from this system. But I also say that, you know, the weapon systems that both China and Russia have and deploy are designed to bring pain to us at home, right? To turn the lights out in Washington via cyber attack, or to take away GPS capabilities, which wouldn't just mean you're driving your car into the water, right? It means, you know, all the way financial transactions get timestamps and train signals and so on. Anyway, the weapons are designed to make it so we feel it too in the event of a conflict.
Yeah.
Our guest has been Jim Sciutto. His new book is The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. And Jim, since writing seems to be a kind of passion and habit of yours, I expect that in a couple of years' time, there'll be another book, and I hope we'll be able to bring you back as a guest on Shield of the Republic.
I'd love it. It's a real honor to speak to both of you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Jim.